merchandising, merchandising, where the real money from the movie is made. Spaceballs the t-shirt, Spaceballs the coloring book, Spaceballs the lunchbox, Spaceballs the breakfast cereal, Spaceballs the flamethrower. The kids love this one. Last but not least, Spaceballs the doll, me.
May the Schwartz be with you.
Adorable.
Welcome, dreamers of all ages, to another episode of Unbuilt and Unrealized Theme Park Podcast. With me today, as always, is my co-host Ryan Dorman, and we are just wrapping up Spooky Month. And how are you doing?
That was my little ghost. Yeah, it's finally. It feels like Halloween has just passed.
Well, it's actually still the 27th when this comes out, so.
No, I know, but it's over. The problem is once we've concluded this episode, I don't know how I'm supposed to get back into the Halloween season.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah. See, you just measure everything through what we're doing on the
Unbuilt.
Show. I see.
Yeah, Unbuilt okay. It takes up most of my mind. I set my day up around it. When we're not recording, I don't do very much of anything. I just kind of photosynthesize.
I went to Walmart last week, and there was Christmas decorations already up. Like,
were there also Halloween decorations?
Well, that was the thing. Like, there's one section you go in, you first see the Halloween stuff, and then if you go in the back, it's all Christmas already.
Oh, I mean, you know, Thanksgiving's not that fun now that I think about it.
It's just food, and we can buy food any day. It's not that special.
Walmart has that every day. That's not necessarily interesting. I mean unfortunately it's gonna come earlier and earlier, but if we keep talking like that, we're gonna sound like crotchety old people.
Oh, like not like we already do.
I'm like,
well, we're talking about it, some crotchety old people today. Now, I don't know if he'd be crotchety. He's more delightful.
He's got energy.
Figure. Yes, he does. And he's still alive, God willing. I mean, we're talking about Mel Brooks today, and we're recording this earlier than usual because both you and I both go out of town like subsequently for some reason.
That's right. And yeah, so I mean, it's just perfect storm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're recording this like nearly 2 weeks ahead of schedule. And I'm just scared that like a leaf is going to land on Mel Brooks and he's going to collapse and he'll be dead by the time this episode comes out. It's nerve-wracking.
You know, I hope that isn't the case. What am I supposed to say to that? What?
I don't know.
in the way that in preparation, if he does die, he was a brilliant comedian, and you can take this clip and you can put it in the front of the episode. Just put my clip there,
and then
I think he'd be okay with that.
Yeah, and if he's not, he's well past his prime. Let's be honest.
Yeah, he's a. You saw that History of the World Part 2?
Oh God, I watched like an episode. I couldn't get through it.
Aww.
No, I don't think he was barely part of that. I think he probably showed up, consulted on a few things, and then like did some cold opens, and a bunch of millennial writers took care of the rest of it.
Paws of Fury was really his passion project.
Oh, God. I did not see that. Not even.
Neither
close.
Did I, which is a shame because Blazing, what the hell is it called?
Blazing Saddles?
No, not Blazing Saddles. What was the original name of Paws of Fury called?
Oh, you're right.
Blazing Samurai. Like that's
Blazing
right.
Blazing Samurai, yeah.
Yeah, that was, I'd heard about it for years and years and years. And I always
it
was
in development hell, like for
exactly.
super
and
long.
And then it comes out and I didn't see it. I don't know why.
Nobody did. Because they it saw like it and it was like, well, this looks like garbage. Yeah, but we are talking about him when he was like still doing good stuff, I think you would think. Yeah, and we get still to go back to your one of your favorite parks, Disney MGM Studios.
I don't think I like anything anymore.
My gosh. Well, okay.
No, I love everything. I mean, I love everything. I love the listeners.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about like parks in their prime.
MGM Studios, sure.
Obviously, first one would be Epcot, right? And then second, would you say Disney MGM Studios?
Parks in their prime? You know, I would say that I'd still lean towards Animal Kingdom, but I think that MGM in its prime, you know, was some really, of course, nostalgic and brilliant stuff. I always like when we talk about old MGM because it really had an identity to it that didn't make it into the present day.
Into the present day.
Yeah, not at all. It died on the corner of the street, you know.
You just saw it, witnessed its death in what, like 2017 when they took out the Great Movie Ride?
Yeah, someone drove by and stabbed it, and the ambulance kind of never came. They kept promising, but that body's still there.
I don't know. I think I visited in the hospital the other day, and it was in a, vegetable state, but it's doing well.
It's getting IV drip from Toy Story Land, but...
Hey, they added that new projection mapping effect in Muppet Vision.
The problem is that like there's like a big new casino opening next door, and all the power is going to get siphoned out of that hospital. So when Epic Universe opens up, Hollywood Studios might have to be taken down to the morgue or something.
I mean, they did tear off that tumor like the other day. Wait for you to get the joke.
What are you referencing here?
So it was a tumor. It was chopped up off about 2 weeks ago. And it was quite an expensive tumor.
The hotel?
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. But the problem is that tumor was like on the brainstem. So it was like the newest thing that the body had. And... Now there's just nothing. Like, there's not even brain function, and there's no transplant opportunity.
Okay, well, I think we've had enough of the metaphor.
I wasn't even talking about the metaphor anymore.
Well, okay. So today we're talking about Mel Brooks's Hollywood Horror Hotel, which is nicknamed often Hotel Mel. And this topic is interesting because it is fascinating. And at the same time, just like our topic 2 weeks ago, there's like no concept art for it. Like none of it exists. Like there's no concept art to latch onto. And frankly, there's even less information out there on this besides it being just an idea and kind of the history of how it went. But what it is an evolution of an attraction that came to be. So that's, of course, another element to it. With that said, I think it's time to go into our main topic. All right, here we are, main topic time. Mel Brooks, we talked about him at the top of the show. Dorman, what is your favorite Mel Brooks movie, and what is your least favorite Mel Brooks movie?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a very interesting... You caught me off guard here. My favorite Mel Brooks directed movie is probably The Producers.
The Producers. Obviously, I know what probably your favorite movie that Mel Brooks had some hand in is, but...
hey, it's Brooks film. Elephant Man is Brooks film.
And I don't think it's my favorite year. but what is your least favorite Mel Brooks movie that you've seen? I don't know how many of them you've seen.
I've seen a lot of the big ones, and I think if I had been a bit more... outgoing and seen more of his movies, this wouldn't be the lowest on my list, but I'm not the biggest fan of Spaceballs.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
I think Spaceballs just like of the Young Frankenstein is a literal classic. Blazing Saddles is a literal classic. Producers is a literal classic. Spaceballs is ass. But
okay,
I think that, you know, to be clear, that's a low level on a list of pretty great movies. Like, I haven't seen Dracula's Dead and loving it. I haven't seen the silent movie one or whatever one he did. But I do feel like of the four I've seen, Spaceballs is the one I watched when I was like 13 and I thought it was really funny. And then I watched it like 3 years ago and I didn't think it was funny anymore.
Okay. So when I say this, it's not necessarily because I disagree with you. It is because I have seen Spaceballs probably about, I want to say give or take about 50 or so times. It's probably the movie I've seen the most of my life. And so my favorite, almost kind of by default, has to be Spaceballs. And my best friend and I, growing up, watched it endlessly. There was this one time where it was on HBO, and it was one of those weeks where they had, like, the HBO. You could get it for, like, you know, a limited time. You could get it for, like, a weekend. And they would give it to you as a preview for a weekend to entice you to purchase it. And Spaceballs was on. And so they were taping all the movies that they could get at weekend on HBO. And so he taped it. And we would watch it like over and over and over to the point where he actually had the movie memorized. I have the movie about half memorized. And obviously that's probably gone away with years. I'd have to ask him how much he's knows. I mean, currently he's married with two kids. He just recently just had a kid. Congrats, Kyle, by the way. And so I don't know how much he remembers of the dialogue Spaceballs, but it's quite a bit. And I mean, there are scenes that I could quote easily. Merchandising, merchandising, merchandising. Where the real money of the movie is made. there's everything about it I could go off on, like, immediately. I'm a Mog. Half man, half dog. I'm my own best friend. This is a movie I know by heart, and even if it is strange and it doesn't always work, but it's so funny. Rick Moranis is amazing in it, and his improv with Mel Brooks and what the guy who played Colonel Sanders, whose name is escaping me. I can't get enough of it. It is one of my favorite movies of all time, unapologetically. But I get why people don't like it. I get it. It's just it. I saw it at the exact right time at 8 or 9 years old and memorized it. Like, so you have to take that into consideration. So that is my favorite. I would say that his best film is probably Blazing Saddles. And my least favorite movie of his is easily Dracula Dead and Loving It. It's terrible, horrible film. But I have seen pretty much nearly every Mel Brooks movie. I think the only one I've never seen is 12 Chairs, but I've seen every single one. And I would have to say that I'm even a fan of, have you seen Robin Hood Men in Tights?
I have not.
Okay, that's another movie that I watched a lot in my childhood. It has a young Dave Chappelle in it, weirdly enough. Very funny. I'm also quite fond of Young Frankenstein and The Producers, obviously, as well. Yeah, his movies definitely were a huge part of my childhood. I think they're extremely quotable and fun. The musical's a little less so, but I can't say that Mel Brooks didn't have a huge influence on my life and my view of comedy, even though I kind of recognize it. It's very Borscht Belt, and it's not subtle. but it's still a kind of comedy that I really am endeared to. Yeah, so I'm sorry. I love Spaceballs. I don't know what to tell you, man.
It's different strokes. You know, yeah. The thing is that I think I'm a bit more poisoned to Star Wars and that kind of stuff and like parody. That's true. So mm-hmm. I'm born, you know, born in the 2000s, raised on the internet where everything is a parody and shit like that. I live in a post Spaceballs world. So it's a bit harder for me to look at anything based on Star Wars or Star Trek without like cynicism because that's, it's so messy.
Yeah, I get it. And yeah, I saw this film in 1996, maybe.
Exactly.
And I mean, I had not seen most of the Star Wars films before I saw Spaceballs.
Oh.
So just prefacing that, that very much, I'm sure, helped. And so when you kind of have that lean on it, and it's just kind of a funny sci-fi fantasy comedy, you know, it very much helps.
Yeah, it's definitely super creative and it's iconic. And there's a lot of things I remember about it. But the problem is once that movie came out, I think it sparked a young Seth MacFarlane to be annoying about parody. And then the world just collapsed.
Yeah.
From there, it was like everything. You know, Pizza the Hut is a funny joke in 96, but in a post-Robot Chicken world, it's like, okay, I've had enough. But that's nothing to do with the movie. And and when I say, let's talk about the ride. But when you know, to be clear, Spaceballs is not a bad movie. It's just like became the template of all comedy for the past 20 years.
I think my friend and I will, like, upon memorizing it, we really like to latch on to the little details and the little off aside. Like when he's eating Pizza the Hut, like he's eating him and he goes, "You're delicious." It's just such a random aside. He's just eating him. And it's just little things like that we really loved. And like looking at the goofs in it, like when the little alien comes out and does "Hello, my baby," which is still, I hate to say a Larry the Cable Guy ism. I don't care who you are. That's funny right there. And he has a little stick on him. We just latched onto that because we'd never seen that before. We're like, oh my gosh, because we had viewed it like 5,000 times. So. Yeah, it's a personal favorite of mine, and I'm sorry. But anyways, let's get into who Mel Brooks is, because I'm sure there are some Zoomers here who are like, "Mel who? Who?" So let's go into it. Mel Brooks already had quite the career before 1968. A writer on Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar, polishing various books and musicals and creating The 2,000-Year-Old Man with Carl Reiner. But his real break came when he was asked what his next project would be during a press conference. His answer, Springtime for Hitler. Eventually, he formed a script about two scheming Broadway producers who plan to abscond with over $1 million by overselling interest in a surefire flop. Of which, of course, would be the titular Springtime for Hitler.
And now it's springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out. Here comes the master race.
However, the adventures of Max Bialystock and Leo Bloom would not see the screen until Brooks changed the title to The Producers, and it became a cult hit. He even won an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay, remarking on its brazen satire and razor-sharp wit, not to mention the winning performances of Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder bringing it to life. Now, for The Producers, what I find is interesting about The Producers is I think that it falls apart a bit in the end. And have you seen the musical?
Just no, I don't. I don't watch musicals.
Okay. I think the musical has a better ending, while the Producers 1968 is a better movie. But that is
ending in the musical. So, like, very briefly.
Yeah. So in the movie, they go and their last ditch plan is to blow the theater up.
Yeah.
In the musical, there's kind of like a Leo Bloom runs off with Ula, the secretary, with the money. And Max is jailed. And Leo has a change of heart and comes to Max's aid in the trial. And that's when they just lock them up and put him in jail. So I always thought that was a little bit of a smoother ending. I think that the ending of the original was trying to be a little too edge and a little not soft-spoken. With it's just kind of like callous
producers.
Idea. Yeah, I know. But it comes off as abrupt to me. That's all.
Okay.
Oh, well, let's blow up the theater. And it just doesn't, it's not as funny as the rest of it.
Boo. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay. So back to the history. After a setback with the 12 Chairs, Mel doubled down in the satire and parody with 1974's Blazing Saddles, starring Gene Wilder and Cleavon Little, about a black man who becomes the sheriff of a town intentionally to drive out the townspeople in a nefarious plot. And it could never be produced today.
No, because Gene Wilder's dead.
Yeah.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know. Morons.
We could never make Blazing Saddles today.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. The film was a hit, but Brooks wasn't done yet that year, coming out with Young Frankenstein, also starring Gene Wilder, from an ideas of Wilder himself. In it, Wilder plays Frederick Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein. My name, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Anyways, Frankenstein inherits his family's castles in Transylvania and suddenly becomes obsessed with also bringing a monster back from the dead. A great deal of laughs follow, including a famous sequence where him and the monster dance on stage to put in on the Ritz. And again, Young Frankenstein, another movie that we would watch over and over and over, just like Blazing
I will say, one thing I'll say about Young Frankenstein is that movie, in my opinion, is his best directed movie. I think it's an incredibly well-made movie.
Agreed.
Where you said the producers falls off at the end, I think Young Frankenstein, probably from putting on the Ritz on, becomes a nightmare of a movie.
Oh,
like to me, I think the ending in Young Frankenstein is funny. But it's funny. Actually, you know what? Take what you said about the ending of the producers and put it here. I think what does the movie end with, a dick joke?
Yeah, basically he sleeps with.
but he's got a massive. He's got a massive dick.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, we're explicit, right? I can say.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Anyways, that's Young Frankenstein is a movie where it's like, I don't know who was the cinematographer on that movie, but it's this beautiful love letter to, you know, old Universal horror movies. And then I think by the end just becomes a bit messy. But yeah, I just wanted to put my hat in here and say that Young Frankenstein is pretty excellent. And now that I think about it, you might be onto something with Blazing Saddles being his best movie.
Yeah, I think Blazing Saddles, it probably has the cleanest ending. And I will agree that Young Frankenstein's ending isn't fantastic. I think the first two thirds of it are much stronger than the last third. By the way, the cinematographer of Young Frankenstein was Gerard Hirschfeld. And let's see what he's done. He did Diary of a Mad Housewife. Oh, he did My Favorite Year. He did To Be Not To Be. He did some Mel Brooks films, but it doesn't have like that big of a filmography.
It must just be Mel Brooks's like keen eye for recreating the visuals of those older movies.
Maybe,
it's a really pretty movie. It's a really beautiful movie.
No, I agree. With this, Mel Brooks locked himself in as the master of parody, producing four parody films over the next 12 years. Silent Movie, which is good. It's solid if you haven't seen it. High Anxiety, which is mixed results. History of the World Part 1, once again, mixed results. And Spaceballs, which we've talked about already. And of course, we have to give a tip of the hat as an uncredited producer of David Lynch's The Elephant Man. There you go.
He called Michael Eisner a monkey, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But what's so funny is, like, I did not know that Brooks Films is a part of it, but Mel chose to be uncredited as a producer on The Elephant Man.
Yeah, he felt that it would make it, it would devalue the movie because you'd see the name.
His name was beyond it, yeah.
Yeah, you would see Mel Brooks and be like, oh, it's a comedy, and it's the saddest movie you've ever seen in your entire life.
Yeah.
Yeah, he apparently saw Eraserhead and just thought that David Lynch had what it takes, what he needed to make this Elephant Man movie. So
he's not wrong.
Yeah.
And so in 1988, production wrapped up on Touchstone Pictures' film Big Business, which stars Bette Midler. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I've never even heard of it.
Guess what it's on? It's on Disney Plus.
That's what your 140 a year is going to.
And I have seen it because I was very curious, mostly because of this, because of this whole history of this attraction. It is about, I think it's Bette Midler and, oh gosh, who is the other person that is in it? This is killing me. It's them and they're like, they have identical... They're like identical twins, but each of them, like two sets of twins. It's Lily Tomlin is. So it's like two sets of identical twins. Very strange. And they like have like farcical shenanigans. I guess it's based on a Shakespeare play. So anyways, this film comes out. It mostly takes place in the Plaza Hotel. And the Plaza Hotel... denied filming there. And I looked this up. I was like, does this have anything to do with our great ex-former president? And it does not, because they denied filming like just before Trump bought the Plaza Hotel. So it was like just before it, because I was thinking, you know that rumor that Trump would only agree to have people film at their locations if he could have a cameo?
Is that a rumor?
That's a rumor, isn't it?
It was just true.
I don't know if it's true, but
it happens so frequently that it must be true.
Must be true, yeah.
Like, if he was on Fresh Prince, he was in Home Alone 2. It's like, God, he was on everything.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it was just a hair close. But anyways, they were denied filming, and they had to build an exact replica of the lobby to great extents. Seeing a solution, Disney CEO Michael Eisner arranged with Mel Brooks and his production company to build a sitcom around the set, which became 1989's failed The Nut House, starring Brooks' favorites Cloris Leachman and Harvey Korman. So these sets were still standing, and they just kind of reused them on the LA lot. So what happens, weirdly enough, by the way, to just tie up this portion of the story, the show fails like immediately. Like, I think they only like film like a few episodes, and they still have these really expensive sets, so they send them the Disney MGM Studios in the soundstage restaurant where they were for a while, where you could eat in those sets.
Oh man, that's like salt in the wound. Imagine producing a movie or producing a show that did so poorly that now people are eating in your sets.
Yeah.
They're eating like chicken tenders and cheeseburgers.
Well, it wasn't their sets. It wasn't theirs. That was Big Business's set. So no matter what, they could actually go, you know, hey, this was in the 1988 film Big Business.
And then not the Nut House.
Right, exactly. Now, it didn't matter that the show was a flop, because Eisner saw it as an opportunity to whisk Brooks off to Florida and make Disney MGM Studios his new home. With the Nut House as a taste of the action, he knew he needed an extra morsel to entice Mel to make Orlando his production home. Well, Mel's son Max was a huge fan of Disneyland, and the idea came about to give Mel his own ride at the new theme park. Mel was initially hesitant to the idea, but he became more enamored once he learned that it was a way to have his work seen every day by thousands of people for 10 to 20 years. Michael set off his Imagineers to work, who had several phone calls and sit-downs with Mel before producing their first pitch. Castle Young Frankenstein, based on the film. Guests would walk around the streets of Bavaria in the queue before heading over the drawbridge into the castle. Inside would be a ride set around the events of the film. Well, Mel wasn't a fan because he was seeing it as kind of well-worn territory. He wanted to do something new, but he liked the idea of the mix of funny and scary. Thus, Imagineers went back to the drawing board, producing Mel Brooks's Hollywood Horror Hotel, commonly nicknamed Hotel Mel. The idea would be that guests were invited to the set of Mel Brooks's latest feature, a parody of monster movies. The twist is that it was being filmed at a genuine haunted house. Okay, guests would interact with actors who would turn out to be the actual monsters themselves, as we learned via various gags. One would be Dracula trying to shave himself, but constantly getting nicked because he can't see his own reflection in the mirror. Steve Kirk had the idea that this would transform into a celebration of Mel Brooks' work, as guests would take various forms of transportation to enter different Brooks' work in a massive show building that had different buildings within it. The Art Deco haunted hotel tower overgrown with ivy would merely be the facade. Another wacky idea is that this would actually double as a real hotel, filled with sight gags as people would stay in it, complete with their own transportation from the Orlando airport to complete the immersion. Sounds familiar. You're speechless. You're speechless?
Look, not every idea we talk about here is the best idea.
Oh, okay. Sometimes it's good that there's a big drawing board, is what you're saying.
Sometimes people should learn from failed history. If Unbuilt does anything, it should be a tableau for Imagineers to learn what didn't work and what they shouldn't do again, because it's dumb and it'll never work.
Right. So why was it not built? Brooks and WDI disagreed a lot, as he wanted us to do something new, and they kept pushing towards nostalgia. Also, a disagreement that was being had was the ride itself. Some wanted a walkthrough, some wanted a dark ride, and Brooks even suggested an elevator that goes horizontal instead of vertical. Ultimately, Mel Brooks walked away from the project in the early 90s, but another team at WDI were working on a pitch that we talked about called Geyser Mountain, which involved a version of an Intamin Generation 1 freefall coaster. The idea of a horizontal elevator intrigued some people working on the team, as well as that vacant, haunted Hollywood Tower concept. After musing on an original murder mystery concept, Kevin Rafferty and Steve Kirk then brainstormed and came up with the idea on the spot, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. As for Mel Brooks, he then produced Life Stinks, which stunk. Terrible Damn. Film. Yeah.
Tear them apart.
So, anyways, what if the Hotel Mel was built instead of the Tower of Terror? And it's hard to really think about it because this is assuming that the attraction was made, but what variation of the attraction? It doesn't seem like they had a full idea of what it wanted to be. And I think the reason why the Imagineers kept steering back to his old movies is because it's easier. Would you say? Yeah, it's easier to sell that concept.
Yeah, it's easier to sell that concept and to pull audiences in if they're already familiar with it. Yeah, I mean,
I know that Disney MGM has a lot of experience, I guess I would say, with trying to turn more mature content into something family friendly. The Great Movie Ride, of course, has that a lot in spades. But of course, The Great Movie Ride was also doing a lot of, shall we say, nostalgia bait. And I'm sorry, but it really was. I mean, if you put away your own nostalgia for The Great Movie Ride, what it really is in 1989, it is a lot of nostalgia bait.
Well, yeah, it is. And it, it, it had to bring some legitimacy to the park about movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to do that is to pull from the golden age of cinema.
Right.
Right. You're dealing with, in the 1980s, you're probably dealing with what parents watched. By the early 2000s, it was what grandparents watched. Mm-hmm. And kind of why the movie faded out of favor. Mm-hmm. Or the ride faded out of favor. But yeah, the problem with movies, I think, is that it's really hard to predict what's going to be famous in 30 years.
Yes, agreed.
You know, it's incredibly hard, especially when we're kind of in the short term, movies are entertainment. In the long term, movies are cultural touchstones. So in the short term, you can put on whatever you want. You can pick any kind of Frozen attraction, let's say, and hope that Frozen stays around and stays big forever and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But with Hollywood Studios or MGM, because they were trying to go for the magic of the movies and the great movies, of course, you couldn't really just pick something that had just released. I think it was going to be a little bit more difficult. So as a result, right, you have to dip back into what is already a cultural touchstone, what's already classic, mm-hmm, what's already going to be famous forever. It's right. Why I think Young Frankenstein and eventually The Twilight Zone are the two choices that Disney was most comfortable pushing for this horror-themed attraction.
So you don't think that the idea of it being just kind of a general monster movie parody,
no, or that would
horror
fail.
Parody, just, it, okay, so...
yeah.
Yeah,
it would have been a miserable flop, because the problem is that, and let's, you know, this is one of those interesting cases where we're not going to be quite talking about something that wasn't built and was replaced with something totally different. We can talk about something that was built, or sorry, we can talk about something that wasn't built and that was replaced with something incredibly famous and similar.
Yes.
Right. The Twilight Zone Tower of Terror is one of, if not the most popular ride on premise right now in Walt Disney World.
Right, right. We're talking about a evolution of a concept and one of its de-evolved states. Okay.
Exactly. Well, yeah, one of the early states. And the problem is that the current state, well, whatever the current state was created for, this previous state was designed to placate a director.
Right.
Right. Or to placate a specific name to get on the attraction, hoping that just like the great movie ride features John Wayne and Singing in the Rain and, you know, Footlight Parade or the fuck that movie's called, this would say Mel Brooks. There's some legitimacy. He's one of mm-hmm. the greatest comedic minds in Hollywood. Unfortunately, I think that the legs on that are really limited. It's a very short-sighted idea.
Right.
Because the carrying factor in the Mel Brooks attraction is that it's Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think modern audiences, at least, you know, let's talk from today. I don't think that today's audiences like funny horror at all. In fact, I think they hate it. I don't know why that is.
Okay, but that's an interesting thing to point out. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that.
Can you give me one example of a contemporary funny horror film that has made the splash of real horror movies?
Okay, I would have to say, and I know you're going to poo-poo me on this,
okay,
but here's...
Haunted Mansion.
I have... No.
Throw it out there.
God, no.
The onion
God,
rings
no.
from
no.
Burger King.
Yeah, oh my God. I think I would have to say Jordan Peele's movies. And
what?
Yeah, I know what you're gonna say, but it is a comedian making horror movies, and I've seen all three, and they do have comedic bents with them.
Okay, but you have to recognize that in zero of the Jordan Peele horror movies,
okay.
What? they're not funny. They're comedic, but they're not funny.
Okay,
It's not a satire. It's not a parody.
You want it to be a straight up like horror comedy. But I think that people do go to Jordan Peele movies with the expectation that they're both going to be scared and laugh. I really
Yeah, but that's
do.
Not
I
Dracula really nicking himself with the shaver.
Okay, but yeah.
That's like Kiki Palmer's funny before, like, Daniel Kaluuya gets sucked up into a horror monster beyond any of our imaginations.
I think that... Now, like, I think that when you're talking about horror comedy, it can straddle a lot of lines, but I think what we're talking about here is is more or less more cheeky comedy. I don't think anybody would be parody. I don't think anybody was going to be scared by this film. Now, would you consider something like Arachnophobia? Is that a horror comedy to you?
No. Okay, it's even funny though it was filmed, shit.
Oh my god. Okay, I'm done. I like Arachnophobia, sir. You apologize to Frank Marshall right now.
I think that okay to me. All right, here we go. Here's my pitch, and this is the best way I can frame this. Gremlins 1 probably could do well today.
Okay.
Gremlins 2, I don't think so. And I prefer Gremlins 2.
I would say Gremlins 2 is a straight comedy, though. I don't see that as a horror comedy.
Well, okay. Okay, let me back away then. Let me pause and renegotiate my argument, because I think maybe the syntax is wrong that I'm using here.
Yeah.
I'm not saying... okay, here we go. You're talking about horror comedies. I'm talking about comedy horrors.
Okay, there we go. That's perfect.
So,
yes.
Yeah. I don't think a comedy horror works today. I have yet to see a comedy horror movie in the past 5 years do any meaningful... do anything meaningful, like there's, in the box office.
I would have to say there's literally one exception, Goosebumps? And that's when it comes to animation.
I think the only
thing that is able to do that, because like you had the Hotel Transylvania movies were very popular.
Sure, I would agree with that. So, I would agree with that, actually.
So those are the only exceptions, but in live action, yes. And that, I think, is because... It's not necessarily because of the fact that it has horror attached. I think it's just because comedies are just really in a poor state right now. I think that's just overall the fact.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you. That's a fair point. I think making a comedy movie nowadays is not easy, and the only way you can bill it is if it's for children, which is, like you're saying, animation is not only for children.
I know.
Animation is art, says Guillermo del Toro, making children's movies. But I think I love Guillermo del Toro. That was unnecessary shade. But I think that if the problem is that, so if we're speaking strictly from today, right? You know, imagine that this ride is built and it's a parody of Universal horror movies with comedy being the forward push, like the front is that it's a comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the success of Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, and I don't think audiences give a rat's ass about the Twilight Zone.
No.
Unfortunately. But
no, you're right. Yeah.
The sense of theme is so strong, and the archetypes of the Twilight Zone that aren't, like, you don't need to know it's Rod Serling, but you need to know it's a creepy guy who talks in 50s voice. That's scary. That, like, has lived on. It's successful for all audiences. I can see what Michael Eisner was doing in the 80s with trying to get Mel Brooks to headline this attraction. However, I do feel like how could you predict that audiences wouldn't be into comedy horror? But once that shifted away, I don't think that this attraction has legs, because I don't think a majority of audiences are going to laugh at this.
I know it's an interesting thing, because comedy, I would have to say that attractions that are super steeped into comedy are harder to last than others. And a long, long time ago, when we were working for the Boardwalk Times, I did a list of the top 10 comedy attractions, the funniest attractions in Disney. And a lot of them are gone. a lot of them are gone. And the number one, obviously, was Muppet Vision. And Muppet Vision is almost there despite itself. Like, it's so just hanging on a thread. And
Muppet Vision is only there because of the Muppets, I think. You know, and frankly, probably because of Sesame Street. I know that's a weird thing to say, but the cultural power of the puppets, whether they be Muppets or Sesame Street, is what's keeping it there. Not the content, which is great, but I don't think the content.
No, you're right. You're absolutely correct. But I mean, even thinking about lesser attractions that were trying to elicit a laugh, like Sounds Dangerous of Drew Carey, like just never worked out. It just completely fizzled. I mean, you have attractions that were Austin Tim, they were just comedies by default, because that's how they wanted to jazz them up, like Ellen's Energy Adventure or the redo of O Canada, that were, you know, largely revolving around, you know, comedic personalities and comedic scripts. And those just never measured up to snuff. And I think the thing that helps something like the Haunted Mansion or Pirates of the Caribbean and its Mark Davis gags endure is the fact that, you know, they're going in with a theme first and gag second. So it's secondary to it. It's not the whole appeal to it. And I find that kind of fascinating, that when we go to a theme park, we do want to be entertained, of course, but laughing is sort of a kind of a secondary function to everything. Making things funny might be what keeps the Jungle Cruise floating today. I mean, that's literally what it is. I mean, it's a comedy attraction now, but you have the theme of the Jungle Cruise itself being what you rested upon. And that's, of course, what it started out as. And that's kind of how it evolved into that. And you could still strip away the funny humor, but you can't do that necessarily bringing back to Mel Brooks. You can't do that necessarily in a Mel Brooks attraction.
Well, I don't think audiences they don't like humor. The audiences don't like humor anymore. And it's not because, you know, the woke people ruined comedy, but it's because I really do think that people have become too, I don't know, things have become too self-referential. Everything is cynical. Everything is critical, right? Especially in like American media. So the funny thing about movies that we like, funny jokes, are when movies criticize themselves.
Right.
Right. When we dissect these expectations that the hero wins and blah, 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 blah. Or when we dissect like cultural barriers. It's a very critical, in the literal sense, critical style of comedy nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what keeps the Jungle Cruise alive, is that the Jungle Cruise is no longer funny because the jokes are funny. They're funny because the Jungle Cruise is funny. Like the idea of a shitty joke boat tour. You know what I mean? Like, that's the push. And
it's just the way that the skipper delivers it and the speed and the surprise of that.
We expect the Jungle Cruise to have bad jokes.
Right.
That's the funny part, is that there's someone telling bad jokes, like puns. It became funny that people told bad puns. Puns aren't funny, but bad puns are funny. No one wants Jerry Seinfeld on campus, not because he's woke or not woke. It's because no one gives a shit about airline food anymore. Now people make fun of him. Like, what's the funniest Jerry Seinfeld joke in the past 10 years? The guy who did the whole bit about his 14-year-old girlfriend, or his 16-year-old girlfriend or whatever. Yeah. She must have been 18, right?
She was 17 when that was the thing. She was like 17 going on 18 when he started dating her. That was the thing.
1.5 million viewers. We weren't canceled, Larry.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, so when I, back to Hotel Mel, this attraction is like, oh, it's such a neat idea from someone like the two of us, from our perspective, because I think we both like Mel Brooks. I think we both like older horror movies. I think there's something really neat about Walt Disney Imagineering doing a more self-referential kind of thing like that. You know, you even saw styles like this in the Muppet Movie Ride, right? Like this kind of taste of comedy where you take these... In the Great Movie Ride, you have these movies, these cultural cornerstones. And then in the Muppet Movie Ride and Hotel Mel, by extension, you kind of deconstruct them, right?
Well, also another one. You might be forgetting another unbuilt attraction.
Have we talked about it?
Yes, we have.
Oh, Jesus.
2 years ago, we talked about the Creature's Choice Awards.
Ah, that's correct. Yeah, with Godzilla. And was it
Eddie Frankenmurphy?
Eddie Frankenmurphy, that's what it was. You'd be a lot funnier if it was Will Smith, because he could punch.
Oh yes,
that's we could not make
that joke two years ago, but we can make it now.
Someone could have died.
Oh,
someone could have died.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's Chris Rock, but he's a rock monster.
That's right. And
he goes up to slap him and it hurts. He goes, oh, that hurts, because he's a rock, you know.
Oh, that's right. He punches him in the face. Yeah, he says, I'm not the only Rock, and then Dwayne the Rock is there. And yeah. He's even bigger. but yeah, you're right. So that's another case of a meta reflection on cinema, right? It seems like you had the making of the movies, a day when Mel Brooks was the edgy rabble rouser of cinema, but you had the misfits almost. Mel Brooks and the Muppets are, oh God, speaking of Mel Brooks and the Muppets, it's like the worst part of the Muppet movie. Forgot to mention that, right? You like that part?
I like all of it.
That's like a fast forward bit for me. After Rolf and Kermit start singing, I skip until the cowboy scene. I say, I'm good. I've had enough.
Isn't that when, so he gets electrocuted and then doesn't that when the film cuts out?
Oh, and, yeah, I guess you're right.
He goes, oh, come on, Kermit.
That part's good. Yeah. I'll be on pause during that part. And then I like Gonzo's song. I don't know if that's around then.
That's towards the end of the film. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Anyways, so this Mel Brooks attraction would have, you know, brought a bit of funny reflection on the movies. And I think if you're like really into art, like Imagineers are, like probably Eisner is, sounds like a really good idea. But like, so, you know, I wonder how much audiences would have gravitated towards this 10 years out into the future.
But again, that's what I want to know. And, you know, I wanted to say that I really like the idea that Brooks tossed out where it's like, you know, of course they use it, but I always felt like the idea of the elevator in Tower of Terror, obviously the Hollywood Studios one, that comes out of the shaft and moves horizontally. I never felt like it was properly done. And I like the idea of it doing it for a longer ride, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a cool idea. And I wish that they would kind of do that a little bit more. So that one I really like. That said, I don't think that this, if they did it even as a ride, it would probably be seen as much hokier. And I don't think it would have lasted nearly as long as the Tower of Terror did. I think eventually it would be, but it shut down and bulldozed for a thrill ride, you know?
But to be clear, Tower of Terror is a genius idea. Like, it truly is a genius idea. I think you're right about the moving of the elevator. One thing that the Tower of Terror doesn't do, and likely it was because of budget constraints and size constraints, is that it never really highlights that you're moving off the elevator shaft. I think that it does a really poor job.
Tech.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, older.
Yeah, I remember it's 1994. They They barely have this. I mean, it's essentially a trackless vehicle. And they barely have this technology working. I mean, damn thing breaks down all the time nowadays. Yeah, agreed.
It just feels like in if there's one failure of the Tower of Terror as it stands, it's that I don't think it gives the audience enough visual direction to indicate that this is something that's weird, like that you're leaving an elevator. And especially sonic direction. I think you very well could have designed a better audio track to make it feel like you're breaking away from like the wall or something like that.
Well, I don't think that, like, okay, so... God, I'm having deja vu. I swear to God, we discussed this before.
I'm sure we have.
But do you know what the architecture of the fifth dimension room is supposed to be? So I had to have somebody point this out to me, and it blew my mind when somebody pointed this out.
No, remind me. We have talked about this, but I can't remember.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be on the. You're supposed to have tilted sideways in the shaft. And when you're moving forward, you're technically moving up the shaft, but it's the shaft tilted on its side. And you can kind of see this. And as you're moving on its side, it's literally as you're moving into a different dimension, as, you know, all the imagery shows apart. But you can actually see all the beams and stuff like that on its side.
Oh.
So it's all like horizontal. So that's... And I'm sorry. I know we've talked about this before. I swear to God, we have. So again, I don't think it like kind of really makes itself as known because it's too strange and too abstract. To be honest,
it's too abstract. It's too strange, and it's not motivated. Like it doesn't. It gives the impression more so that you've like literally translated forward. It's the whole thing is too visually grounded that it just feels like you're breaking free of the track, maybe floating away. But if it's supposed to be that you're entering the sideways elevator shaft, it just doesn't really work.
Right.
But it's an interesting idea. And it really isn't surprising that someone like Mel Brooks would propose that, because that's the kind of style of comedy that he tells. Mm-hmm. Is what if X did Y? You know, elevators move up and down. What if they move left and right? It's like, okay, that is somewhere to go. Like, that's something to do. It's an interesting idea. If they had done that, I think eventually, World might have gotten Tower of Terror anyways.
That's true. Like
if they had built an elevator attraction that moved, it probably would have closed in 10 years and become a thrill ride.
Became it anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe without the Twilight Zone, or maybe with, I don't know. I mean, it happened to be like the exact right time. Like CBS, apparently when Kevin Rafferty like called them up, they're like, oh, yeah, absolutely, go ahead. You know, I love hearing, like, let me know what you feel about this. And, like, his book, he talks about when he pitched it to Michael Eisner and Frank Wells. And Michael Eisner goes, does anybody watch the Twilight Zone anymore? And Frank goes, are you kidding me? They run it every 4th of July, Mike. Come on, Mike.
And it's all like, free advertising. Yeah, every year, every new year, it's like a whole day of advertising for the Tower of Terror, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
So it was like, it's a classic. You have to put it in, and now it has almost nothing to do with the Twilight Zone. But it doesn't matter because people love it too much. And we'll see if we ever get that Taika Waititi movie. Maybe not.
Who gives a shit about that guy anymore?
Yeah.
Hack.
You're not going to see what's the next goal wins?
The big transphobic one.
Did
you hear about that?
What? Can you explain that to me? Because I haven't heard the details.
I'd have to Google it. It was like something about that in one of the original cuts, I think the coach uses misgendering to push a person to do better in the soccer game.
But they cut that out?
I don't know if it was ever cut out.
Okay.
All I know is that in early test screenings, the coach uses misgendering to push someone to do better, and then the kid apologizes for getting angry at the coach.
Oh, jeez.
And the weirdest thing is that didn't happen, like, in real life. The guy that it's based off wasn't like transphobic. Like, there wasn't even a case where that happened. So Taika Waititi just wrote into this real story that the guy was an evil monster who abused people. And everyone who was watching it was like, why is this still in here? I don't know if it made it to the final cut.
All right. Interesting. Okay. So would we want Motel Mel to be built? I think I know my answer. You know your answer.
Well, don't be so sure.
Oh, all right.
The problem is that with Hotel Mel, okay, it didn't seem like Mel Brooks was really interested, right? It kind of seemed like he didn't care all that much, mm-hmm. aside from giving a couple of ideas here and there.
He engaged with it, but it
was kind of like, you know, if you show up on someone's doorstep for 3 months with flowers, you might go on a couple dates. But like, those dates are going to suck because you kind of, it was forced, you know, it wasn't like a love child of creative passion. So on one hand, you know, I have to curtail my expectations knowing that this was a push specifically to get Mel Brooks' name on it. On the other hand, I'm really curious of what it would look like. But if we're talking for like the general health of Hollywood studios, if we're talking about what it needed, and also what would have produced the best outcome, a world of Mel Brooks' attraction, a world of Tower of Terror, then, you know, I can't in good conscience say that they should have built the Mel Brooks ride.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to have seen it, though.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree with you. I think that, no, it probably shouldn't have been built. Am I curious? Yeah, I am curious. But there's not enough in there that really gelled. And again, this is probably why it collapsed, because there just wasn't anything concrete in there. There was just tossing a lot of ideas out. And I mean, when you don't have a strong enough idea, then what's the point? And of course, Rafferty and Kirk, they just come up with immediately, Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, and it's like, boom, right there and then. And it becomes a classic e-ticket attraction. I think it's very obvious the right kid got built, you know? The wrong kid didn't die. So, yeah, I can't say it shouldn't have been built. It should have been built. I don't know. Yeah.
I wish we lived in a world where I could see it.
Of course. I mean, that's the thing with all these unbuilt attractions. It's, you know, waving the what ifs versus, you know, what weren't. And, you know, and again, a large part of this podcast is looking at the consequences of when you do decide to build it, you know, what goes on the wayside. And of course, we have to consider a world without Tower of Terror. And no, I don't want to live in a world without Tower of Terror, because that's a possibility. It could be a possibility of being made, and we would have eventually gotten Tower of Terror, maybe even a better Tower of Terror, but I don't want to take the risk. But wouldn't it be nice if we could just see everything, you know? I mean, wouldn't it be nice if, I don't know, somebody, I'm going to LA next, like later this week, any Imagineers could just like hand me over the keys to 1401 Flower Street, and I'll just go and peruse their archives and get everything they got on every unbuilt attraction and try to replicate it that way. But that's not going to happen. I only have my limited resources for now. So yeah, I would always love to see it, but what can you do?
That was sad.
I know. It is
sad. That was the bleakest ending to an unbuilt we've ever done. And now that Mel Brooks is dead, I don't know what to do.
Oh my gosh, don't say that.
I thought we were preparing in the case that he did.
Well, I mean, eventually somebody is going to be listening to this in the future when he is dead. So there's that. So even if he hasn't died by the time that this comes out, eventually
don't keep that in. Don't keep poor Mel Brooks is gonna actually die now that we've said that.
Oh, he's not. Oh, I mean, he's 97 unless he lives to be 2,000 years old, like the 2,000-year-old man. I don't know, but I mean, he's getting there. Just watch. It's like he somehow outlives both of us. I don't know.
I hope he does, frankly. I mean, I hope that we live a long life, but it'd be kind of cool if, like, the oldest person ever was Mel Brooks. He's, like, 500 years old. He becomes Yoda. He'll turn into a little Yoda.
Oh, yogurt in Spaceballs. Yeah.
See, that's it. That's the kind of Family Guy humor I can't get around. I can't do that anymore.
Spaceballs the flamethrower. Spaceballs the dolly.
That's, you know, Elon Musk. Schwartz
be with you. Adorable. Told you.
The problem is that now the Star Wars machine is worse than ever. So it's like Spaceballs even doesn't capture it.
Don't watch Spaceballs the animated series. It's horrible.
Is that really a thing? I can tell
you that. That is really a thing.
What channel did it air on? It aired
on G4.
There you go. That's why I was asking. Because I was like, there's no fucking way this wasn't G4 or like Spike TV or MTV or something like that. Oh, yeah.
And it sucked. It was so bad. And I would love to say Mel Brooks wasn't involved, but he was very much involved. And that's the thing. It's so sad.
I mean, I think the problem is that Mel Brooks was a very real artist around up until the 80s. But the problem is that the kind of artist he was died with Johnny Carson. You know, it's like the witty, quick, and clever comedian. Kind
of Borscht-Belt comedian, yeah.
Yeah, it fell over because it's like vaudeville was murdered by, you know, the 90s, 90s late shows, SNL and The Simpsons. It just became a much more, that's just not how you did it. Conan O'Brien.
Cynical and self-aware.
Which is
surreal.
Exactly. And especially nowadays. It's such a shame because like it's funny, you watch clips of Don Rickles or something like on Johnny Carson, and it just feels like such a different universe.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And Mel Brooks, I think, did his best to acclimate to that environment, you know, like instead of just kind of getting lost in the past and doing smoke bar rooms and stuff like that, he tried to make Spaceballs. He made Dracula's Dead and loving it, you know, but I think that
he recognized when it was time to exit.
Yeah, you got to know when to quit.
Yep.
You got to know when to quit. But he was in Toy Story 4, so it's okay.
That's true. That's
Melephant Brooks.
Yes. We will be back in November with a long-awaited series. And I think things are going to get a little beastly. I think so. So get excited for our Animal Kingdom fans out there. Now, this is one that's people been waiting for a while. But in the meantime, please follow us on social media on Twitter at UnbuiltPod. You can reach me at OpenMothersMail and Ryan Dorman at OpenDorman. Feel free to email us at UnbuiltPod@gmail.com and rate us wherever you find this podcast. We currently have a Ko-Fi at Ko-Fi.com/UnbuiltPod. For $3 a month, you can get bonus episodes. And for $5 a month, you can get your name read on the show along with early access episodes and bonus episodes as well. We'd like to thank our current contributors, Joseph Antone and Jalen Harvey. Please write a review and tell us how we're doing. And if you don't like us, thank you for listening to I'm Surrounded by Assholes. I'm Andrew Sanders. See you guys.
Did I miss something? When did we get to Disneyland?